Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday. What am I saying? Monday, January the 22nd, with the good music of my friend Carlos Guedes. We get started on another program. In a minute, we'll be chatting with our friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to look at foreign policy a little bit differently today than we have in the past. You know, in the past, when we've spoken with Barry, we've looked at events, you know, like World War II or the Battle of this or the situation in North Korea, the situation with Iraq, Iran, and so on. But today we're going to look at foreign policy from a broader perspective, and we're going to try to understand what is happening to the United States, or where does the United States go from here in a world that is obviously very different than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago, or whenever a lot of our international commitments and arrangements like NATO were made. So I think it's going to be a fascinating topic. I know that Barry has a lot of interesting things to say about that. Just a couple of quick things on this day in history. These two things actually happened on the same day in the same year. Fascinating coincidence. But it was on this day in 1973 that my dad, my brother, and I sat down to watch a boxing match. And in 4 minutes and 45 seconds, or 4 minutes and 30 seconds, something like that, the match was over. The fight was over. George Foreman, almost killed George Frazier, or Joe Frazier. I'm sorry. Foreman just destroyed Joe Frazier. And it was the most amazing 4 minutes of boxing that I have ever seen. And to sit there, we had food on the table. We were going to enjoy lunch watching the fight. And all of a sudden, man, this thing was over in 4 minutes. It made, of course, Foreman the heavyweight champ of the world at the time. On a sadder note, on this day, also in 1973, Roe v. Wade. And, you know, looking back at it now, you have 45 million babies who have been aborted. But I think for me, the most difficult part about Roe v. Wade is what it has done to our rhetoric and what it has done to our civility. And all you have to do is watch a confirmation of a Supreme Court justice, like Gorsuch, for example, more recently. Every question from the Democrats is about Roe v. Wade. Are you going to overturn Roe v. Wade? Are you going to overturn Roe v. Wade? It's almost like it's become the only issue that matters to the Democrat Party. And it's kind of sad because I don't think that was what was intended. Let me say hello to my friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio, as well as any member of the petite bourgeois deserves to be on a Monday morning.
In the West Coast of all places, huh? You're out there in the wonderful state of California, where things like the politics get more flaky every day, Barry.
Well, as your listeners who've listened for a while may know, I used to live in San Diego, which is arguably America's finest city. Now I've moved to La La Land and work in Beverly Hills. Mm. So I'm living among the rich, the famous, the glitterati, and being reminded every day of my lack of any of those things.
you don't go shopping to these fancy places where you always see these movies, you know, of these Beverly Hills shops, you know, where you walk into the shop and walks out a movie star or something like that. I mean, have you had that experience?
Hasn't happened to me yet, but I'll let you know when it does.
All right. You let me know when Raquel Welch shows up. And
well,
tell Raquel that I used to remember her when she looked a lot better.
Well, you know, I've seen many beautiful people, and I've seen occasional movie stars. I even treat a few in my clinic, but so far no one's discovered me. I have not myself been discovered and you know, walked down to the studios for my screen test with Mr. DeMille. I'm still waiting for
close-up. Well, you know, we believe in lighting a candle for our friends. So I'll light a candle for you and hope that that happens someday.
Well, you were talking about Joe Frazier and George Foreman.
Yes,
can I interject?
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because that was the most amazing 4 minutes of boxing that I ever saw, Barry.
Well, as we were old enough to remember
yes.
these things, as we approach our coming daughterage, Joe Frazier had just come off of fighting Muhammad Ali. He was the heavyweight champion. He was smoking Joe Frazier. He had kind of a Mike Tyson style. He'd get low and he'd bob in, keep bobbing and weaving, staying low. He was a small guy, but very powerfully built, like a fire hydrant. He'd really had a brutal fight with Muhammad Ali that may have taken a bit out of him. But it wouldn't have mattered because George Foreman was a giant. He was a huge man, incredibly powerful, with a very powerful left jab and an incredible right hook. His left hook was pretty nasty, too. And as you said, in the first round, he knocked Foreman down. I'm sorry, knocked Frazier down, I think three times, and three times in the second round when he finally called the fight. My memory of that fight is this clip I'm about to play you, which is Howard Cosell, inimitable Howard Cosell, was narrating the fight. And he was astonished as anybody when Frazier got knocked down the first time. This is the famous line that everybody remembers from that fight.
I'm glad you found that. I'm glad you found it. Yeah, go ahead.
Down goes Frazier.
I remember that. That became almost like his signature statement. I just remember sitting down with my brother and my father, and my mom had made us some sandwiches or something, and we thought, well, we would enjoy our sandwiches and watching the fight. And I don't think the sandwiches were ready when the fight was over, Barry. I mean, it was just remarkable. I mean, it was, I don't remember now whether that was on free TV or whether we paid for it. I don't remember. I know my dad was a huge boxing fan, and he used to pay for fights, so maybe he did pay for it. I don't remember. But, man, that was – you know,
like the time when the Dallas Cowboys under Troy Aikman played the Buffalo Bills in the early 90s or late 80s.
Yes.
And every time I got up to use the bathroom or get a sandwich or get a beer, Dallas would score another touchdown.
Right, right.
And it was like you couldn't leave for a second before they wouldn't score again.
Well, as I was joking with my brother later that afternoon, the song "I Am the Walrus" was longer than that fight, because "I Am the Walrus" is like 4 minutes and 35 seconds.
Right.
I think the fight was about a few seconds shorter than that. So just by coincidence that afternoon. Just sitting there joking with my brother, I just happened to have a copy of Magical Mystery Tour, the album, in my hand. Oh, yes, it is. And then I look at the time of the song, and I said to my brother, you know what? I Am the Walrus is longer than that fight. And, well, it was a bit of comic, a little comic relief. I don't know how much my dad paid for that fight. I'm not sure he was thrilled about the fact that it was over in 4 minutes, but because those things were expensive, as I recall, but it was a moment to remember. Now you have an on this day in history you want to share with us today.
Well, yeah, this is January 22nd. On January 7th, 22nd, 1879, the red-coated British Army had one of its great military disasters occur, and one of the greatest victories, all on the same day. It was at the hands of the native army of the Zulu nation in South Africa. The British had, in January of that year, they had marched into Zululand to annex the Zulu kingdom. The Zulus were a very powerful African kingdom founded by Shaka, using tactics which I believe he might have learned from probably European missionaries or European traders. Modeled very closely, looked like to me on the Roman legions, But in any case, the Zulus in great force, 20,000 Zulus, met a British army camped on the slopes of a mountain called Isandlwana, which means the crouching lion. And on the slopes of Isandlwana, the British camp was overrun, and 1,400 troops, British and native contingents, were wiped out in one of the most stunning defeats of British colonial power. That same day, a force of 4,000 of those Zulus detached from the main body and tried to wipe out the British rear guard, which was defending a mission station filled with supplies at a place called Rorke's Drift. And the British, using flour bags and wagons turned on their sides, created a redoubt around this mission station. And 120 British, or excuse me, 170, I think it was 170 British defended this against 4,000 Zulus all day.
Mm. Wow.
And repelled them and succeeded in repelling them. And 11 Victoria Crosses were awarded, the most ever awarded in a single engagement in the history of the British Empire.
Wow, that is remarkable. Well, you went to see a movie. I think you were planning to see a movie last night, the movie about Afghanistan. And I saw the movie about Churchill a couple of weeks ago, The Darkest Hour. And I thought that was a great movie. It reminded me a lot of the shows we've done, that movie. And by the way, my favorite performance in the Churchill movie, The Darkest Hour, my favorite performance was Mrs. Churchill. I just thought she was great. I mean, she was just fabulous in that movie. And I had seen another movie called The Gathering Storm that came out like 10 years ago. I don't know if it was a movie or HBO movie, but it was a good show, I thought. And Mrs. Churchill was great in that, in The Gathering Storm. But she was just, I mean, the character, whether that was the real lines or whatever, we will never know. I'm sure some of it is, but in the movie, the Darkest Hour, the character, the lady who plays Mrs. Churchill, is just absolutely lovely, not just physically, but her personality. I mean, and it just made me think how lucky Winston was to have Clementine as his wife. That's all I could think of, Barry.
Well, he met Clementine in the soon after he came back from, I believe, the Boer War. And by the way, she's played by Kristin Scott Thomas, who is a remarkably beautiful and intelligent actress.
In this movie, you mean? In The Darkest Hour?
Yes. Darkest Hour.
Yeah.
Kristin
Scott Thomas. I didn't know her name, her real name, but she's just a beautiful character.
Well, your fans may know her from she played the main character in The English Patient. She was the love interest of Ralph Fiennes. And then she was also in Three Weddings and Four Funerals, or whatever that movie with Hugh Grant was. But in any case, she's a beautiful actress. But he met Clementine coming back from the Boer War, and that was one of the, you know, back in those days, people didn't get divorced like they do today at the drop of a hat. So they were married their entire life, and she was quite a helpmate to him.
Yeah. Well, my favorite line of Mrs. Churchill in the movie, there's a scene when Churchill is prime minister under a lot of stress and obviously dealing with some very difficult problems. And she walks into the room and I'm paraphrasing what they said. I don't remember the exact language, but it went something like this. She walks in and he says, "No, please go away." And she says, "It's too late for me to do that now." I could have done that years ago, sort of like, it's kind of too late now. I'm in this with you, so it's too late now. And I just
indeed
thought that was a great. But how was the movie? How was the Afghanistan movie that you went to see?
Yes, it's the 12 soldiers, and it's about the American horse soldiers, the American Green Berets, 12 of them, an A team, ODA, Operational Detachment A. Of the 5th Special Forces Group, that were the first American combat troops to fight against the Taliban and Al Qaeda in Afghanistan following 9/11. Within the weeks of 9/11, we deployed these guys over there through Uzbekistan, and then from there dropped them into Afghanistan to link up with the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance was a loose collection of rebel groups, rebel in the sense they were fighting against the Afghan Taliban government, which had won the civil war that followed the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. That civil war had been brutal and bloody and never really reconciled with various factions. So the Northern Alliance, made up of Tajiks and Uzbeks, was fighting against the Pashtuns, which were the Taliban. And, you know, this sort of tribal war has been going on in Afghanistan forever. But the Taliban were particularly brutal the way they treated people. And, you know, they had a loose grip on the country. But the Northern Alliance had not moved an inch, so to speak, across the dividing line between what they controlled and what the Taliban controlled for 11 years. And then America, after 9/11, got involved. And using Green Berets, our 12 guys got in there, embedded themselves with General Dostan's forces in the Northern Alliance, and were able to use bombing, you know, targeting, laser targeting to bomb Taliban positions and just turn the tide of battle within a matter of weeks. Within 3 weeks, they had taken their primary objective and broken the Taliban's defensive lines. And within weeks, the Taliban collapsed. So 12, and they're called horses. They were called horse soldiers in the book because they rode into battle on horseback, just like their Afghan allies.
Right.
So Chris Hemsworth plays the leader of the operational detachment, ODA, and it's a good movie. It's a good combat movie. It's a good view of the war in Afghanistan before we got deeply involved. Mm-hmm. It's a tiny piece of history, if you will. I advise people to go out and read the book Horse Soldiers.
Not to be confused with the John Wayne movie, of course, which is one of my favorite John Wayne movies, The Horse Soldiers. You may remember that movie as well.
Yeah, that was about Garrison's Raid, wasn't it?
I think so. There's also a very pretty lady in that movie, The Horse Soldiers, the lady from the South that they run into.
William Holden. William Holden takes a shine to her.
Right, exactly. In that movie, she's a very pretty lady too. I can't think of her name, but she was a Southern lady from, I guess, the ranch. And I don't know whether – I cannot remember right now whether she was a widow or a single lady, but she added some charm to that movie. Sometimes when you have war movies, it's kind of nice to have a lady, you know, that kind of adds a little charm to it. And that's one of the things that Mrs. Churchill does in that movie, The Darkest Hour. You know, she has that feminine touch that sometimes at least, you know, changed the pace a little bit, if you will, of a movie that is otherwise, I mean, the Darkest Hour is a pretty dark movie. I mean, that's what it's supposed to be. You know, the Darkest Hour, we remember doing a show about that period back a few months ago. So it's nice to see a pretty lady in there making it a little bit better.
Well, your intrepid correspondent here has looked up an IMDb and found that that pretty lady in the John Wayne movie played the character Hannah Hunter, and she was in fact a widow. And her name of the name of the actress is Constance Towers.
Mm.
And I don't know that I ever saw her in anything or much of anything beyond that movie, but I do remember her.
Yeah, I just remember they went into the ranch, and I guess she. Now you're right. I think she was a widow, and as there were many widows, unfortunately, at that time of American history. Well, I tell you what we're going to do. Let me take a little break, and then when we come back, we'll get into our foreign policy topic, which is just absolutely fascinating today. Because as I was saying in the introduction, normally you and I look at like hotspots, or we look at a country, or we look at a battle. But today it's going to be a little broader, and we're going to take a picture of the world, if you will, from a little slightly different perspective. So let me take a little break. We're going to come right back. In the meantime, we're going to hear from one of the Blog Talk Radio sponsors, and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting today with our good friend Barry Jacobson, who I had a feeling, Barry, that you knew something about that Frazier fight because you and I seem to have similar interests. So
we do.
So when I mentioned it, I had a feeling that you were gonna say something about it. But George Foreman, of course, went on to become better known for his cooking. than for his boxing.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, he does all these infomercials now of, you know, George the Cook. In fact, he even has a book, apparently, that he wrote about it. So he's made a lot of money cooking beef, I guess. But let's talk about our topic today. You came across an article, and it's a fascinating topic. So tell us about it, Barry.
Yes. Well, you know, every year or a couple of years, whatever, the Department of Defense comes out with a summary of national defense priorities. This is the first one for 2018 to come out from the Mattis Defense Department. And it's striking in that it changes America's focus from anti-terrorism, which it has been since 9/11, in which all our forces were geared towards the counterterrorism mission, and refocuses it on what our traditional role has been, which is countering global rivals. And what makes this a particularly interesting document is that it clearly defines who our enemies are. Enemies in a very loose sense, you know, they're rivals, probably a better word, and who we need to prepare for and against, and how to do that. As all these documents are, it's in general terms, it's not specific. You don't want your enemies to know specifically what you're going to do, but it lays out some interesting principles and outlines the sort of the situation. If I may read briefly from it, I'll fill it out your audience's knowledge of this real quickly. It says, today we are emerging from a period of strategic atrophy, aware that our competitive military advantage has been eroding. We are facing increasing global disorder, characterized by decline in the longstanding rules-based international order, creating a security environment more complex and volatile than any we have experienced in recent memory. Interstate strategic competition, and not terrorism, is now the primary concern of U.S. national security. Goes on to say, China is a strategic competitor using predatory economics to intimidate its neighbors while militarizing features in the South China Sea. Russia has violated the borders of nearby nations and pursues veto power over the economic, diplomatic, and security decisions of its neighbors. North Korea's outlaw actions and reckless rhetoric continue despite the United Nations censor and sanction. Iran continues to sow violence and remain the most significant military challenge and the challenge to Middle Eastern stability. Despite the defeat of ISIS's physical caliphate, threats to stability remain as terrorist groups with long reach continue to murder the innocent and threaten peace more broadly. It goes on to say how the United States military must be a more lethal, resilient, and rapidly innovating joint force, combined with a robust constellation of allies and partners, which will sustain American influence and ensure favorable balance of power that safeguard the free and open international order. And one of the most interesting things it points out is the security environment is also affected by rapid technological advances and the changing character of war. The drive to develop new technologies is relentless, expanding to more actors with lower barriers of entry and moving at accelerated pace. New technologies include advanced computing, big data, analytics, artificial intelligence, autonomy, robotics, directed energy weapons, hypersonics, and biotechnology, the very technologies that ensure we will be able to fight and win the wars of the future. The strategic approach must be that we must be strategically predictable but operationally unpredictable. We must integrate with U.S. interagencies. We must counter coercion and subversion from our enemies, and we must foster among our troops and officers a competitive mindset. These are all very interesting points, and what Secretary of Defense Mattis is pointing at is we need to change our thinking to one more nimble and one more in mind that the enemy has a say in these things and that we're really into competition. We got to outthink them, not just outfight them.
Mm-hmm.
There's just as much courage in the heart of a Russian soldier or Chinese soldier or North Korean soldier as there might be in an American soldier. We're not going to defeat mm-hmm. them simply by being braver. We got to be smarter. We have to have better weapons and better technologies. And really, in the last 10 years, we've really allowed our technological edge to atrophy. Mm-hmm. And that's got to come to an end. And it's only going to come to an end when Congress and the president together come together to spend the money, you have the will to spend the money it needs to update our military and to implement these things that Secretary Mattis is talking about.
Yeah. It seems to me, Barry, that we're at a crossroads when I think of the United States as a superpower. We came out of World War II, obviously, as the superpower, and we fought really until the 90s. We fought a war, or we thought we were going to fight a nuclear war against the Soviet Union. We had all these different wars around the world, but that was the big one that we thought we were going to fight, so we had to have more nuclear missiles, more nuclear bombs, and so on. But now it seems like the challenges are twofold. On one hand, you have the Chinese gaining advantage, maybe not directly militarily, but moving around. I mean, their Navy is growing, as you've told us many times on the show. But then you have this little terrorism problem, which is, you know, where all of a sudden, you know, a city could be paralyzed, not because of a nuclear attack or not because of an army attacking you, but because of all these terrorist threats. And clearly, in the case of terrorism, we have to be a step ahead of them. We have to be able to get the information, infiltrate the different groups so that we can be, you know, we have as much information in advance as we can about what these people plan to do. So as you say, it's not so much how strong we are, but we have to be smarter too and getting information. So we're going to be a different superpower over the next 30 years than we were over the last 30 or 40, Barry.
Well, that's true. I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is in order to be a superpower, we have to be able to vie on the world stage with other emerging powers and be able to defeat them. The definition of a superpower is one that can project power anywhere in the world, which is something we've been able to do since World War II. We do that through basically two means. One is air assets, the ability to project troops or attacks using air power. Or air transport, and sea power, the ability to move ships anywhere in the world ocean and project power that way. In the days of Ronald Reagan, we had a 600-ship Navy. Now we're down to less than 280 ships. And while some of the ships are more capable, generally speaking, one ship can't be in two places at one time, can they? So numbers do matter. Even though our troops are more lethal than they were, say, in the days of Ronald Reagan, our equipment is better. We used to have 15 divisions. Now we have less than that many combat brigades. A division, by the way, is made up of three brigades. So we have about a third of what we had at one time. And it's even worse than that, because when you look at the number of planes that actually can fly, that have the parts to fly, it's about 25%. We are really, really facing shortages of equipment, of supplies, of replacement parts. There was an article some years ago about how some of these airframes are so old that we're using that in order to get parts for them, which are no longer being produced, by the way, we have to go to museums and cannibalize parts from museum examples of that plane. Which is just ridiculous. So something needs to be done. We need to modernize our force. We need to have the ability to fight a war on at least one and a half fronts, if not two. It used to be we say we could fight a two-front war, essentially. We could fight a war on a two-step war simultaneously. The idea being that we could fight a war in Asia against China, for instance, or North Korea, and at the same time deter the Russians on the plains of Germany. And that was downgraded during the Obama administration to say we could fight one and a half wars. But really the truth is we'd be hard-pressed to fight one full war, one full-size war against a real rival like China over, say, Taiwan, or Russia over, say, the Ukraine. That has to change. And one of the things I wanted to talk about today was the idea of hegemony and how great powers, which have dominated their world at the time, historically have collapsed. Because I think we're at a crossroads, Silvio. We're at a period where we have enjoyed a long and almost sleepwalking period of dominance. And we've been lulled into, a false sense of security and a false sense of our own superiority, in fact. One of the things that Mattis mentions in this paper is that Americans cannot take it for granted that we will always win future wars. It's not a God-given, right that we will go unchallenged, that we will always dominate the battlefield. That's something we have to earn every time. You know, there are powers, for instance, like Sparta comes to mind. I'm getting very esoteric here. But I am a historian. That's sort of the province of historians, is to be esoteric and to be able to find analogies that pertain to our times. Sparta, at the end of the Peloponnesian War, which was the first great global conflict of the Greek world, the Western world, fought against its longtime rival, which was Athens, and came out victorious. And for a brief period of 20 years, Sparta had no rivals, and they had no one challenging them. No one would think to challenge the mighty Spartan army in Greece or abroad, for that matter, until someone did. And what eventually happened was other powers realized that Sparta had an Achilles heel, and that Achilles heel was lack of manpower. Their army was superb, but it was small. It was very elite, but it was small. Very much like the American military. It's very elite, but it's not very large compared to other nations. Yeah, we have the biggest military, but the combat component of it is fairly small. Most of it is support. So Sparta could not take a licking. Its manpower was so limited that if they lost a great part of it in one big battle, which they eventually did, they couldn't replace those losses. And eventually when they lost the Battle of Leuctra against the Thebans, and then 10 years later, another battle called Mantinea against a coalition of other Greeks, which again included the Thebans, Sparta never recovered because they lost too many of their core manpower. And they became demoralized. And that's something that happens in these circumstances, is a great power, when it hits that tipping point, it gets tipped over the edge. Often there's a movement among those people, among the empire or the kingdom, to reassess, really, is it that important to be a great power? You know, what has it gained us? You know, the British Empire at the end of World War II, and really at the end of World War I, the British people began to wonder, is it really worth it? Is the cost of empire really worth what we're paying for it, for the glory of being an empire? And after World War II, they passed the baton to the United States and said, no, it's not. You know, we're going to let our empire go and focus on enjoying life, perhaps, and having a rebuilding Britain back home instead of these great global commitments across the globe. So there are all these examples. Another example is Athens at the end of the Persian Wars. The Athenians had created this great empire fighting the Persians, only to eventually get to the point where they overreached. And an example was they attacked Syracuse in Sicily, which was far too far away from their base of power. And the debacle resulted in the loss of their fleet, which they were really never able to replace. And Athens, after that, never recovered, was ever a great power again. So the United States is at a point now where we could continue as a hegemon of the world, but it won't go unchallenged. China wants to dominate its part of the world, which is the Western Pacific and Asia. And they're building a blue water navy to challenge our navy. And they have interests across the globe. They have, they're beginning to build bases even in Africa. They control the Panama Canal through a corporation of the Chinese government. Russia is exerting itself all throughout the edges of its sphere of influence, including in the Middle East. And there'll come a time when we will be challenged. And if we lose that challenge, America may well slip back into being a secondary power and look inward, as we historically have, rather than outwards, become more isolationist, which is the traditional American model, after all.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because I think that there's a lot of Americans who are not – maybe they don't realize – what they're doing, but I think a lot of Americans will say, you know, what are we doing here? What are we doing there? You know, I've had people say, let the Middle Easters, you know, let the people in the Middle East kill each other off. What does it matter to us? And I would think that many Americans even think, you know, let the Chinese build all those islands in the Pacific. What's the big deal for us? And of course, the problem is, as I see it, is that that when another superpower expands, it comes at the expense of the other one. I mean, I don't know if I'm making myself clear with what I just said, but I mean, Chinese will grow at expense of of the United States. If they become more powerful in the Pacific, we will become weaker in the Pacific. And what that means, for example, let's say North Korea, what that means for commercial, because a lot of it too is economic. I mean, these commercial lanes like the Panama Canal and some of these sea lanes around the world, a lot of it is commercial, what moves through those. Oil moves through the Persian Gulf, for example. Not the Persian Gulf, but the Gulf. The Gulf there? I can't think of the word right now.
The Straits of Hormuz and the Malacca Straits.
Right. I mean, that is a critical, waterway. We can't just say, well, we don't care about it, because if it were to come under, let's say, the influence of Iran or another hostile power, it could have an economic effect on the United States, could drive up the cost of oil. So all of these things are related. And I'm not sure that we have the luxury to back away, but we need leadership that reminds us of that. We didn't have it under President Obama. I think we have it under President Trump, but I'm not sure if it's the same kind of leadership we had, let's say, with President Bush, who kept reminding us how important these things were. I don't know yet with President Trump. He's done a lot of good things, but I'm not really sure if he is if he's the kind of guy who thinks like previous Republican presidents, Bering.
I think due to this, what I'm seeing in this paper, and you, of course, you have to read between the lines in these things because they're written in general terms. But I think the threat is articulated well, and I think that the press understands that we need to rebuild the military. He talks about it all the time. But he needs cooperation from Congress. Congress controls the purse strings. And the Democrats, through sequestration, have really gutted the military. In case your listeners don't understand what that means, sequestration was a deal made between the Obamas and the Democratic Party under Obama. And they're, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in Congress and Senate Republicans, that for every cut in discretionary spending that came out of non-defense spending, in other words, social spending, an equal number of dollars had to be cut from defense spending. It was a 50-50 proposition, 50 from defense, 50 from social spending. That was demanded by the Democrats and by Obama to get any sort of reining in of spending in general. As you remember, during Obama's time, our deficits were ballooning. His first year was in $1 trillion in the first year, and he doubled the national debt in his 8 years. So the Republicans trying to cut back on spending, which we absolutely have to do, proposed various cuts, and the Democrats demanded that half of those cuts had to come from defense. That was called sequestration. Problem is, defense spending is only 18% of the budget. It's not 50% of the budget. So taking 50% of all cuts out of 18% of the budget, whereas only the other 50% come from the rest of the 60% of the budget that is social spending, didn't make a whole lot of sense, and really disproportionately hurt the military. So our military is a hollow force in many ways today. It's capable of anti-terrorism mission because that's a limited mission by nature. But if we had to fight a big war right now, we'd be very hard pressed. And I think Trump sees it. I don't know if the Democrats see it. And without the Democrats agreeing to spend the money that's necessary, our military really cannot rebuild to do what Secretary Mattis says it has to do in this defense document.
Yeah. And this document, what is the name of the document, Barry?
It is the 20th century, the 2018 National Defense Strategy of the United States of America is the name of the document. Sharpening American Military's Competitive Edge, that's the title.
And this is a document that the Secretary of Defense This is sort of like his state of the Union address. This is like, you know,
Right,
what he,
exactly.
how he sees the world. Yeah, it's how he sees the world.
2018
But it's a
National Defense Strategy Summary.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, and a lot of what he's talking about there, I guess we will be looking at over the next 5 to 10 years, because I mean, it's a dangerous world. And the biggest problem that I have is, you know, you have countries like some of the NATO countries that I guess want to be protected, but don't want to join in the protection, if you know what I mean. And so you have a situation where I can certainly understand an American soldier, or not a soldier so much, but the parents of a soldier saying, wait a minute, why is my kid going over to Norway to defend Norway, and when the Norwegian boys don't want to do it? You know, it's a heck of a lot easier when they've got some skin on the table. It's a heck of a lot easier to defend them. But that doesn't seem to be. So I understand that frustration. I wouldn't call it isolation. I would just simply call it, hey, if you're not willing to defend yourself, why should I defend you? So I understand
too,
Barry.
Well, yes, there's a very good Netflix series out of Norway, since you mentioned Norway, called Occupied, that I recommend to all your listeners. Occupied, it takes place shortly in the future, maybe 5-10 years in the future, in which the United States takes that very attitude, and we pull out of NATO, because NATO has become nothing but the United States as it is today, spending our money to defend Europeans at no gain to us. And so we pull out of NATO, and NATO collapses. And so in the future, yeah, the EU is on its own. And the story is that during a energy crisis, the Russians occupy Norway to take their oil. And it begins with the every episode is a month, and it begins with the occupation, which begins covert and then spreads from covert to overt occupation, much like what happened in eastern Ukraine. And eventually, the EU dithers and dallies, but does nothing, until finally, by the end of the first season, the Norwegians are beginning to fight back, you know, with the resistance
mm-hmm.
movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a far-fetched scenario by any means.
No,
not
at all.
You know, Americans are tired of defending a continent that is
mm-hmm.
very wealthy, that could defend
mm-hmm.
itself, but prefers to spend money on butter rather than guns. They'd rather
right.
spend money
and,
on cushy vacations than its own defense.
Right. You know, everybody gets a month off for work or whatever. All of that, obviously, is a great thing. But if you're doing it at the expense of defending, or you're doing it because you're expecting the United States to defend you, at some point that's going to get old. Now, Europe, and I just want to say this, leave you with this thought. I just saw an article over the weekend that in the year 2080, that's not long ago. I mean, that's not that far. I mean, what, that's what, 80, 70 years? Not even that long, 65 years? That Italians are going to be a minority in Italy. And so when you think of Europe, you know, you have to think of a continent 40 or 50 years from now that is going to look very different than the country that we entered into agreement with NATO. So that's another thing to consider, all these demographic changes in Europe that are that are changing that continent, Barry.
Well, there's a book out which talks very much about this. There's been several, but one's called The Strange Death of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Europe is the dying, you know, of basically, you know, suicide by not reproducing itself. You know, the Europeans
mm-hmm.
don't want to have children. Instead, they're importing workers from mostly the Middle East or North Africa who have nothing
mm-hmm.
in common with them when it comes to values. They're
right.
not being assimilated and are producing 5-10 children, you know, per family. It's
mm-hmm.
by Douglas Murray. It's called The Strange Death of Europe, and I recommend it. We may well be looking at Eurabia in another 30, 40 years.
That's right. No, it's it's a very realistic. I mean, the numbers don't lie. You know, it's like, you know, it's like the, if you're not planting, you're not going to have a crop, if you know what I mean. I mean, you have to be planting or
That's
seeding
right.
your field right now if you expect to have a crop at some point down the road, and they're obviously not doing that in Europe. Well, Barry, as always, it's a great honor and a treat to see you or to hear from you or to chat with you. Let's do it again whenever you have some time off and you want to chat with me, just let me know and we'll arrange it. I mean, I absolutely love doing these things with you.
Absolutely. And the nice thing about our ever-changing world is the fact there's always something to talk about. We never run out of topics, do we?
No, and with you, there's so many common things to talk about. That's what's fun. I mean, you're the only person in the world who probably understands that I Am the Walrus was 4 minutes and 35 seconds long.
Or who the walrus actually was supposed to be.
That's right. That's right. The great debate about who the walrus was supposed to be. Yeah, that's right. Well, Barry, have a wonderful day. And as always, thank you so much for your time.
Take care and have a great day to all your listeners.
Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, great friend of our show. And we've always loved doing these shows with him. We were doing some shows about World War II. Hopefully we'll get back into that over time. But great topic today. Always something thoughtful to talk about when Barry joins us here in the program. I'm sure you've heard by now, just a quick political update. I'm sure you've heard by now that the federal government will be running here, I guess, by the end of the day. It sure looks to me like the Democrats caved in. They basically took the deal today that they had last Friday. I knew that there was a problem with the Democrats on Friday night when six Democrats didn't go along with them, and all of them were what they like to call red state Democrats. I knew at that moment that the Democrats were not united, and President Trump, to his credit, I think understood that too. And he basically said, hey, I'm not going to do anything. You come to me. Well, that's exactly what happened. Senator Schumer went to him today and said, bail me out. Take me out of this. Help. I need someone. Help. And that's exactly what happened. Hopefully we don't do these shutdowns too often. They're really a waste of time. Bye-bye, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.